I'm David Marcus, host of Drinks with the Deal, and today our guest is Cynthia Cole, an IP and data privacy partner at Baker McKenzie in Silicon Valley. Cynthia, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, David. I'm really excited to be here.
So on today's podcast, we're going to talk about your career arc, which started, as so many lawyers do, at a law firm. But then for a number of years, you had positions of increasing responsibility in in-house legal departments as tech transactions and especially data privacy and cybersecurity were becoming increasingly important and were developing into standalone practices of their own. So we're going to talk about those experiences in-house and then how they've shaped your approach as a lawyer back in private practice in the last several years. So with that, tell us a little bit about yourself and how you came to the practice of law.
Yes. Wow. And that was the question that always trips me up, right? Is how did I come to the practice of law, which is, I think, because I didn't want to be an English professor was sort of how I came to it, because I realized that I wanted something that had a practical application in everyday life. And that was missing clearly in being an English professor. So that was sort of the basis. And then also wanting to help people. I get a lot of value from assisting and bringing value to a transaction or to my client. And so that's important to me. So those were the two drivers to go to law school.
And then even though you're not from California and you didn't come from a tech background, you started at a law firm in San Francisco. You started practice in 2000 as the tech bubble was reaching its apex. So what brought you to San Francisco to start your career?
Right. Yes, as I've realized, as I look back over 22 years of my career, sometimes I've had awful timing, and then occasionally I have good timing. So I do think that timing is something that actually plays out in the long term, and you can look back. But yes, I did have what some people would say is bad timing to be a corporate associate in San Francisco in 2000. And so, yes, I did that because, you know, I'm originally kind of moved all over the US, but I lived in the Bay Area when I was younger and I just loved it. I loved the geography, the beach, the mountains, the redwoods, and I wanted to live there. And I also knew eventually that I wanted to be a general counsel and I wanted to be a general counsel of a tech company. And so to me, the only place to start my career would be Silicon Valley.
And so talk about your transition from being a young associate to your first in-house job.
Yeah, so that transition was in 2003. And like many, I was laid off as law firms were closing down and people were losing their jobs and tech companies were shutting down. And so I went to my first in-house position was as a tech transactions attorney in the licensing department at MicroStrategy in Falls Church, Virginia. And that was the first time that I had real, without any real supervision, client interaction, right? And both internal client, like the engineers and the finance team, and then also external clients, like the people that we were licensing the software to and the SaaS providers. And so that was a really scary experience for me. I was really nervous to go into those negotiations without, you know, I felt like I needed to have my hand held, like my hands were held or tied in the corporate department of the law firm where I was before. And my boss at the time, who I credit, I give him a lot of credit because he said to me, "You can't make a mistake." And I couldn't believe that he would say that to me. And I said, "What do you mean? Of course I can make 100 mistakes." And he said, "You can't make a mistake, one that we can't undo." And he said, "I know you have good judgment and I want you to use your judgment and I want you to pause. If you are unsure about moving forward or making a decision, you say, I need to take this back. I need to ask my boss. I need to check with engineering. You know, I need to, He said, use those pauses in the negotiation to get more information and then also to see how badly the other side really wants what they're asking for. So that was, that to me, especially coming from a law firm where it is not often that you're asked to pause in a law firm, you're most likely asked to go all the time and to give answers and to know everything and to be the expert. And here was the advice was take the time that you need and ask the questions and stop if you need to double check what you're doing.
But that is easier to do if you're an in-house lawyer than an outside counsel, correct?
Absolutely. Yeah, it is. And it is because you don't have the same kind of pressure necessarily, right, that you do when you're in a law firm and you just feel this enormous amount of pressure to have the sort of facade, you know, that may or may not be true, that you know everything, frankly.
How much can you just pause? And when can't you do it? When you might be able to do it if you're a lawyer in-house?
So it is harder in private practice because clients are paying you for an answer. They're coming to you for your expertise. They want to know that you have the answer that they don't have, either because they don't have that person in-house with that expertise. You know, I have a team, I have librarians who can do research and different, you know, there are so many ways that I can stay up to speed. But I have learned that being able to understand cadence, right? And being able to work with both the cadence of my client in when they're making a decision or when we're talking about an agreement or the cadence of opposing counsel, that is a skill that I don't think all lawyers use effectively in negotiating. And so oftentimes, you know, I do the same thing. I am trying to create sort of blank space in the negotiation because, again, you see who wants to fill that space. You see if what they're asking for is really truly what they want. And so it's that being able to, again, use it like music, where the pauses in between the notes are just as important as the notes themselves. So you use it. It just depends, I think, on the situation.
And so your next in-house job was actually in Paris. So talk to us about that transition and how, you know, the in-house role differed in Europe, where by this point, it's kind of the mid-aughts. Data privacy was more of an issue, frankly, than it was in the US.
Yes, absolutely. And I changed industries as well. So I moved to Paris. Prior to that, I'd been working in software and SaaS. I went in-house at Global Crossing, tier one telecommunications provider, and then also as regional counsel in Paris, regional counsel for Southern Europe. And was very concerned about data privacy issues, not yet GDPR, but under the directive with respect to potentially having a problem because as part of the service that they were providing, potentially that there would be some kind of backlash or issue. And that was where also I was able to really lean on outside counsel and the expertise of outside counsel and how they could either be very effective for me, right? Especially negotiating I'm fluent in French, but still negotiating with respect to different laws and different issues and negotiating with the incumbent, you know, France Telecom, for example. And then also understanding, again, what I needed and what I really valued in outside counsel.
So what did you find worked for you in dealing with outside counsel and what didn't work? And how has that affected how you interact with clients?
Yeah. So the things that I found effective with outside counsel were the lawyers who took the time to understand my business and also who took the time to understand my role in the company and in the business, that they were sensitive enough to really pick up on all of the context that was sort of driving me and what I was asking, and then just driving the business. And then also it was being responsive in terms of, you know, if I asked for bullet points, I didn't get a memo or, right, that the work product matched what I needed. And I just think it was being relevant. Like, are you giving me advice that I just can't use because it's so esoteric or it's such a long shot? And frankly, I don't like it when people tell me no. So I don't want my outside counsel to tell me no. You know, I want them to tell me what the potential risks and stops are, but then I want them to tell me how I can get around it in a way that makes sense for my business.
So how do you tell a client no if that's the answer you feel that you have to give?
Honestly, I don't have to tell them a hard no very often. That doesn't come up because, again, I'm really trying to problem solve with them. And I think if you are actually invested in your client's goals and in what they're trying to do, then you can find a workaround and you find a way to actually be creative and problem solve with them in a way that hopefully gets them clearly further down the road from a revenue perspective or a data privacy compliance issue or, you know, whatever it is, but that you've also shown that you're creating value to them in a way that also aligns with maybe their personal or their diversity goals or their leadership goals, right? It's all of that that gets, I think, packaged in effective counseling.
So a holistic understanding of the business.
Yes. The business, but also the individuals inside the business, because a business doesn't operate by itself. And it's all the people in the business. You know, many of the issues, for example, in what I do with respect to cyber and breach response, many of those breaches are frankly human error or mismanagement of people. So you have, you know, people who aren't communicating who should be communicating, which tells me that there isn't a facilitation of information across different business groups. And so that's where understanding those people dynamics within the organization is what helps me create a better cybersecurity plan, because I'm not just doing it in a vacuum. I'm doing it with an understanding of where that particular client or that particular company is maybe really good at one thing, but they've got something else they need to work on. And so that's where I can layer in more value add, as opposed to just proposing a plain vanilla security plan.
But presumably a lot of this depends on your ability to ask the right question about the organization, because I'm assuming the in-house lawyer may not be conscious of or may not think is relevant to tell the outside lawyer.
That's a really good question. And I think we get back to what I said before about pausing and listening, because so much information is actually said when you're not talking. And so that's the first thing, is to actually give my client the space to talk to me. So many lawyers, I see this when they give business development, you know, presentations, and they come in with a big line of people and 50 slides in a deck, and right, they want to show their prowess. And of course, you need to show your expertise. But I think so much of showing your expertise is also sitting back and giving your client the space to tell you who they are and what they need. And then, honestly, in today's online age, David, you can go look at people's LinkedIn profiles, right? And understand the individuals. You can go look at org charts. You look online and look at their website and what are they saying about, you know, XYZ. And again, because I was in-house, you know, I maybe understand that language and that lingo a little better because I was in that seat.
And so you were in France for about 6 years. Talk about your transition back to the US.
Yes. So that was the very, very beginning of 2014. And I came back to the US and I did not have a job waiting for me. And I essentially had to start over because I had a lot of people tell me, well, you've been out of Silicon Valley. I mean, I had just been, before returning to the US, I had just been general counsel of what was at the time a $250 million PE-backed multinational company. I had done in the last year and a half before coming back to the US, I had run two acquisitions and the shareholders had changed hands, right? So I just managed three very big transactions for the company. And I came back to Silicon Valley and companies said to me, well, you have no idea what's going on in Silicon Valley. You haven't been here. You don't understand how we're using data. And so we just don't think that you can be helpful. So it was a rough transition back because I came back from Europe and I thought that people would be aware of the same issues around data privacy that I was from just spending all this time, especially in France. And frankly, they weren't. So I kind of got my foot in the door and then got two different general counsel positions, one at a software-defined networking startup. And then my next position was obviously a very pivotal position with respect to next steps in my career, which is where I became interim CEO when the CEO passed away suddenly of a heart attack in May 2016.
And so I'm always struck when I go to Silicon Valley that it is extraordinarily insular. It's one of the most insular business communities, honestly, in America. Has that changed at all in the last 10 years?
So I think it has. And frankly, I would say to my benefit and to Silicon Valley's benefit, I think it has been forced to be more aware of the impact of global regulations, right? And global attitudes, especially with respect to data, personal data, and cyber. And so I do think that it is more open than it used to be. You're seeing a lot of leadership changes. You see a lot more women and people of diverse backgrounds who are general counsel, who have more power. And they are also tasked, frankly, there's been an evolution in the role of the general counsel in the last 10 years. The general counsel now manages things like diversity and inclusion and ESG issues. And so anytime you have an expansion of that role, they have to be more aware of global trends. And they have to be, obviously, with respect to data privacy and security, GDPR, and then the CCPA that, you know, that's passed in 2018 and then goes into effect in 2020. We have a new iteration in 2023. We have China that passed their data protection law recently. We have, right, all of those issues that play right into the heart of what is now, frankly, the focus of tech transactions and strategic transactions, which is much less focused on IP, pure IP like patents, and much more focused on data and AI and the consumption of data and the monetization of data.
So talk about that and how you've seen tech transactions evolve over a 20-year period and what the key issues are now in negotiating those agreements.
So I would say the biggest issue that I see, and this is a real tension with respect to how companies look at data and how they monetize it, is that IP, the goal, let's say, of a patent and is to own it, it is to enforce it and to block others from using it and to try to carve a space in that particular industry based on that ownership. Well, you can't own data. And many companies have taken a long time to move away from a model where they're trying to own data. And now they've realized that, in fact, ultimately, it's the use of data that is what is the most productive, frankly. So that's the biggest change. And a lot of my practice is counseling clients in how they should look. It's training the in-house legal team, it's training different business teams on how they should look at how they position themselves with respect to the data that they collect, whether it's publicly available data, but that is still personal data, or whether it's personal data, you know, any of those sort of mixes of whatever the composition is. And so I think that's the biggest change I've seen.
And in terms of tech transactions, how are tech transactions different now? And what do companies do in-house with regard to tech transactions? And what are they looking to their outside lawyers to provide?
What you said about tech transactions 20 years ago, absolutely. Much more of a niche practice, much more of a kind of side cart to looking at just very specific one or two clauses in otherwise, you know, very complex transactions. and then really not being a sort of rainmaking in itself practice. So what has changed, though, from that is that, again, and sort of what's driving that is that the business model has changed. In the past, it was you have patents, you have software, right? You have something that you are licensing, and it's a relatively straightforward transaction because it's a license. There's a seat license, or there's access to the platform or in the cloud. And there isn't a lot that necessarily is going on behind the scenes. It's, again, pretty straightforward. Well, that has all changed because what's happening is that now those transactions are multifaceted. There could be still a license to IP. There could be that IP license component. But then what's happening is that someone is trying to collect data from the use. And so that adds a whole other layer of complexity to the transaction where many in-house departments don't have, and I think we touched on this earlier too, you know, when I started practicing, data privacy was not a practice. So many in-house teams just don't have that expertise. They have the IP expertise, they have litigation, they have contracts and commercial transactions, but they don't have the data piece. Or they could be a traditional hardware company that is moving into software licensing or data as a service. And they just don't have the internal knowledge that, you know, what that agreement is supposed to look like. And then the other thing is they don't know how their leverage has changed, because so much in every transaction is how much leverage do you have? And if you're the biggest fish, you could be the biggest fish in a hardware market. But then if you're trying to move into a new revenue model that is based on monetization of data or data as a service, you're a new entry into that market. So you have no market share and you have a totally different set of competitors and a completely different set of issues that you have to deal with. And so I advise as well on benchmarking and competitive analysis and what the standard terms for this new business line should look like.
And so switching back to your own career, obviously, you for about 15 years, you had built a career as an in-house lawyer, culminating in being a GC and ultimately an acting CEO. How come at that point, after that experience, you decided to go back to a law firm?
Well, I didn't like my new boss. And so I thought, okay, I need to find a new job, right? What am I going to do? And I had already done what I thought I wanted to do when I graduated from law school, which was be general counsel. And I had learned a lot about maybe more about myself and about what I like to do. And I realized that I was maybe more entrepreneurial than I thought I was when I started out. And so I looked around. I do this a lot. I look at other people and I see, you know, what they're doing. And I think, oh, wow, hey, that looks really interesting. And if they can do it, so can I. And so I saw some people, I met some people who had gone back to private practice from being general counsel. And I thought, you know, at the time, again, that was in 2017. And I knew that tech companies in particular were not necessarily paying attention to the data privacy issues that I knew were coming very quickly, right down the pike. And I thought that it would be fun if I could do it to build a practice focused on that transactional data privacy, tech transactions advice that I felt, frankly, was missing in the market.
And talk about the challenges and rewards of doing that. What did you find difficult about that transition? And maybe what did you find easier than you might have expected?
So the first thing is always billing my time. I find that so tedious and annoying in a law firm, and it's tough. But what I found actually to be much easier than I anticipated was coming from an in-house background and understanding, you know, being a CEO, sitting next to the CEO, sitting in the boardroom, understanding sort of management and power dynamics, if I might say, and also revenue generation, like what that means, right? Understanding that, frankly, every company is operating from, law firms included, operating from how do we make money and how are we going to make more of it? So all of that experience helped me build the practice that I have today, because I wasn't just doing it. I was taking a risk, and some would say I take, you know, more risks than others do as a lawyer, but I was taking a risk. I didn't know if the practice would go, but I knew that I could account for it and try to understand the trends. And at the end of the day, I know whether my practice is profitable or not. I don't leave that analysis to someone else. And I think that's how you run a successful business. And so being able to run the building of my practice from that perspective, knowing that my value is ultimately the value add to the clients, and then am I able to actually make a go of it?
So to some extent, you like the control that you have as a law firm partner that, frankly, in a company, almost nobody has.
Wow, boy, yes. I probably should not admit that. Yes, I do. Yeah, I do. I mean, you're right. You're right.
Mm-hmm. No, I think that's one of the things that many law firm partners like. They do have a control that they would not have if they were in a company.
No, it is true. It is true. But what's interesting, honestly, is I didn't feel like that when I went back into private practice, right? I didn't feel like I had any control at all. I mean, I was starting from scratch. I didn't have any clients, you know, because I'd been in-house, and I felt I was afraid. I didn't know if it would work. I didn't know if I'd be able to build anything that anybody would actually pay for my time. I had a certain amount of confidence in my ability to work with people and to understand the issues, but you never know if it's going to work. But that, I think, is ultimately very powerful. If you can understand that what you're doing is actually very scary and you might fail, but you work through it and you do it anyway, then you always win. Right? You've always won that because you won that battle with yourself.
And so finally, talk a little bit about how you decompress from work.
So how do I decompress from work? If you haven't gathered, I am extremely curious. I speak French. I love to read. I love to learn about new things. I mean, that's what got me interested in working in technology in the first place, is trying to understand how things work. And I love to hike. I love to be outside. I find it really refreshing, actually, to be totally alone, to not have any noise, and to just be outside exerting myself. And I also, during COVID, I joined a band. I'm lead singer in a band. And I just find that, again, that was a really scary experience, being on stage and singing, but it's invigorating and it's really fun. So I try to find things that I guess kind of satiate my curiosity, and then also ways to push myself just a little bit, right? And learn something new.
Cynthia, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, David.
For Drinks with a Deal, I'm David Marcus.